Hey, it's Don Coscarelli, filmmaker. I just wrote a book. Check it out. It's called Fiction, Tales from the World of Phantasm. And it can teach you all the things that you never knew about the Phantasm film series. A lot of interesting stuff. Horror, violence, not much sex. Check it out. Now available on Amazon, paperback, and Kindle.
This is The Gala Show. I'm your reporter on the beat, Gala Avery. On this episode, you may know my guest as the Academy Award nominated writer of the, and I quote, last movie on VHS, A History of Violence, one of the hosts of the Movies That Made Me podcast, or as the writer of Bronzeville. But here on The Gala Show, I simply know him as that guy who knows all of the same South Bay dudes that I do and cut together that compilation of Airport, Josh Olson. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Kella.
We are here on the patio overlooking gorgeous Los Angeles, by the way. I get the beauty seat. I get to see LA.
All the guests get the good view.
All the guests get the good view. So
even though you're the host.
Even though I am the host, I'm the guest of this house. Before we bring up the topic for today, I have a question for you.
Sure.
You are a customer at Video Archives, one of the OG customers. What was it like going there? Because I never did.
Yeah, no, it was great because I had just moved here. I had a place in Santa Monica for a month. I was working on Masters of the Universe, where I was a production assistant, and I desperately needed a place to live. And somebody was like, do you know where Manhattan Beach is? I'm like, I have no idea. He's like, well, I got
Because back then it was literally drug addicts and drug dealers and hostesses.
Manhattan Beach?
Yeah.
Well, Manhattan Beach was always kind of like Hermosa was. Yeah. Manhattan Beach was kind of what it is today, I guess, only a little more. It was like all like lawyers and cocaine.
Okay, so it's still Coke.
Yeah. As long as Coke is the consistent. And someone, I can't remember who, knew a guy who had a garage that he was renting out. So I go down and meet this guy, and I ended up living in a garage for a couple of years, and which is fine because I was working all the time. And I remember this dude sort of immediately figured out, my landlord is like, "Oh, you're a movie guy. There's this video store up the street. You should go check him out. You'd love it." And I did. I mean, I just went in, and it was like, "This is great. This is like, it was the people who worked there, Quentin, Jerry, Julie, Laura, all those folks." Your dad, who weirdly enough, I rarely encountered somehow. I've had more conversations, way more conversations with your dad since then.
Yeah, I know, since then, like since that day.
Yeah, but it was a place you could go. It wasn't like, sometimes you'd run in and go, I need a movie, I got to run in. But it was like, oh, you know what, I need about 45 minutes of like talking movie with like some fellow movie freaks and to go home with like a couple of videos. And it was great. It was a great place. I remember, an early conversation with Quentin where like he'd done a display of Harvey Keitel because he was like one of his favorite unsung actors, which at the time people don't get.
That's crazy that Harvey Keitel would be an unsung actor.
It was just
then.
Sort of like people don't really, he doesn't get the respect he deserves or something. Yeah. And I remember being like, oh yeah, my man. Fuck yeah, Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
And it was just great kind of running into people who were into that stuff. And I know through them, I got kind of turned on, sort of aware of this stuff. I knew of Jackie Chan and so forth. I know I got kind of turned on to John Woo by them.
It's definitely Quentin, for sure.
Yeah, from that, and which is amazing. And then, back, and again, these are all people who are like, oh, big deal. You're like, no, man, if you're sitting there going, no, big deal, you had no idea who John Woo was back then, if you were even around. This was obscure stuff.
I think also, like, the best way that Quentin and my dad described it to me is that, like, you really didn't, and also Eli did a really good description of this, is like that things would be mistitled, you wouldn't know exactly what was what, who made who, and you'd have to go to the video store and just, like, really discover specifically all this Asian cinema, because there was no internet. You couldn't just, like, Google
absolutely.
It.
And then you get into it, and you end up driving downtown to, like, Chinatown or whatever, to video stores and renting these things where, I mean, these are VHS pan and scan where there are five different languages of subtitles going up, down, and along the side, and you can barely see what's happening, but it's still amazing,
That's awesome.
But it was great. I love that place. They moved. I ended up moving to Hermosa Beach, so I still went there, and then they moved down the street. This is long after Quentin and Roger left, but they moved just down the street from me at Hermosa, next to a water ice place, which if you're from Philly, you know what that is. And I would go biking on the beach like every day, and I'd stop for water ice and go hang out at Video Archives and, shoot the shit with the gang there. Yeah, it was a great place. And we have lost, not everyone was fortunate to have Video Archives, but it was not unique insofar as, obviously... Cream of the crop. But there were a lot of places like that around the country, and it's such a loss.
I have to give a quick shout out, though, to some Los Angeles stores like Be Kind Video that are kind of bringing back these video stores.
Yes, it's great.
I love these stores, and I love that you can just walk in and you can. They don't rent tapes out, but you can rent DVDs, which is kind of great.
Yeah.
But you can go in and get movie recommendations. So it's my small little bite of video archives in the modern world. So
they also were up on the you're going to edit this, right? If I tell you something that you might want to edit.
Sure, I'll edit it. Wink,
I think
wink.
It's fine. They were up on the scams. There was a time, because there was a warehouse opened up the street from them. I think, you know, they would Target. Everyone's like all nostalgic about warehouse. Or not warehouse, a Blockbuster. And but Blockbuster would Target a store. They'd see Video Archives doing this great business. They go, oh, we'll open up the street for them.
Oh, yeah,
we'll
open like right across the street, basically.
Up the same side of the block.
Yeah.
And we'll blow them out of the water. Ha, ha, ha. And they didn't. But I remember one of the guys who worked at Video Archives telling me that when they came out with Terminator 2 on Laserdisc, there were two versions. One was just the basic version, and then one was this like big leather box with steel embossed thing that came with all this extras. And they were priced the same accidentally.
Oh.
And then they told me that, where was the other place? There was some other like Tower Video or some other like big chain where you could return stuff without a receipt. And I remember getting the big expensive Terminator 2 box at Blockbuster for like $180 or whatever, taking it to Tower, getting $180 in credit for it, getting a whole bunch of Laserdiscs, including the cheap version of Terminator 2, and then taking the cheap version of Terminator 2 back to Blockbuster with my receipt and getting a refund.
Oh my God, so you basically give a big F you to Blockbuster. It's funny, I always tell people like my one Blockbuster memory is video games. I used to rent video games, GameCube games. I rented The Sims Herbs from Blockbuster. That's like my one big memory, but it would have been great to have video archives.
Terrible place. I refuse to romanticize them. Glad they're dead.
Now, as always, my guest gets to bring their topic to the mic. Josh, what is the topic that we're going to talk about today, and why did you decide to choose it?
I'm not even 100% certain. I'm sort of working on this kind of theory. I'm first of all, disclaimer, I'm going to be talking about a lot of films in a way that makes it sound like I'm making absolute, you know, objective statements about them. And probably one or two cases I am. But for the most part, it's like, yeah, I get it. This is my taste. And I'm also, it's weird because I'm getting to a point in life where, like, I don't want to destroy your joy, you know? Like,
yeah.
If you love a movie that I think, but unless it's a movie I think that is genuinely doing bad in the world, and I think those exist. But, you know, this is mostly my taste. It's good taste, I like to think. It's informed taste. I'm very political. I grew up in kind of leftist movement politics. You know, I tend to be kind of like labor and economic based kind of view of things. I'm very suspicious of kind of contemporary, like democratic identity politics. Just really concern me a lot because I wish this was, you know, they seem to be more invested in kind of symbolic representation instead of actual representation. So that, like, I wish this was my line. It was a guy I personally know said, you know, I'm way less interested in the first black woman president than I am in the last black woman to die in poverty.
Mm.
And we tend to spend all our time focusing on the, like, you know, the highs and lows of celebrities, this as though it matters if, you know, this one powerful person gets even more power. It's like, how does it affect actual constituents? How does it affect actual people? And there's a lot of, like, weird, you know, I'm also like, I like movies that are political. I like stuff, but they have to work. And I'm sort of like trying to develop a kind of working theory about what a good political film is and a bad one. Because to me, it's not about a movie having to align with my politics. I don't base my sense of virtue on the stuff I like. I like what I like. There's plenty of movies with like outrageously awful politics that I love and ones with like great ones that I can't stand. And then there's stuff, and I want to sort of focus primarily on kind of like mainstream Hollywood. And this is going to be kind of maybe muddy. I don't know. I'm really trying to like think this stuff out and trying to just like exploit you coming to my house to like do that.
We're going
to
debate it. We're going to have a chit chat about it.
Exactly.
So,
okay. And, well, and the thing is, so what I wanted, it's like I want to stick to mostly like mainstream kind of Hollywood stuff. Because when I think about like, you know, because I was sort of putting together this kind of list of movies and thinking about them. And then I'm thinking, oh, you know who makes really, really great political movies that don't fall into any of the categories I'm talking. It's like John Sayles. Like, Mate 1 is just like one of the greatest movies ever made. But it's an independent film. No studio would have made Mate 1. And now it's one of the, it's easily the best movie made ever made about unions. So I'm trying to kind of, I've been breaking movies down into kind of these categories of like political films that work and don't. And first of all, I'm going to start at the top by just excising something. It's like people always go to this movie. Are we timing?
No, I'm going to start it.
Oh, my God. I'm already, okay.
No, you're getting, you got so into it. We're going to talk about this political fervor and we're going to talk about movies and we're going to basically, I think we're going to develop your theory on like what political cinema is.
Sure.
And what makes a good political, or what works, what makes a good and a bad political movie. And just to preface this, Josh did provide me with a list of movies. I've watched about five of them. So hopefully I will jump into the conversation with the knowledge that I bring as my young person of, I don't know, my opinions.
And to be fair, I just threw in a bunch of movies I was thinking about we were doing this, some of which I love, some of which I think are vile, and I didn't tell her which was which.
Exactly. So, I have no idea.
I'm praying you saw some of the good ones.
Well, who knows? Who knows what I saw? I liked some of them, so I don't know what that says about me. But 30 minutes on the clock, and our time starts now.
Ah! But first, time for a commercial break.
I might be vegetarian, but that doesn't mean I can't enjoy a good spice rub. My favorite place to get them is Smoke Bros, a veteran-owned and operated business that sells premium handcrafted dry rubs, spice blends, and seasonings. Psst, guys, you can even put it on your popcorn. My favorites are Honey Badger, because he doesn't give a bleep, and jelly and peanut flavor topping, because some things just taste better together. The website even has recipes, so go check out smokedbros.com to support a veteran-owned and operated business and fill your cabinet with delicious flavor.
And we're back. But I say off the top, we got to excise, like, you know, people love it. It's a great film. All the President's Men is so not a political movie. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's an investigation film. It's in the world of politics.
How would you describe a political film? Like, how would you define that?
I think a movie that has a political ideology or an idea that it's trying to get across, or that is expressing an opinion or a view about a kind of, you know, a politics or a political situation, or from a political perspective, whether or not it's intentional or not. You know, there's an awful lot of political films made by people who don't realize they're being political.
Well, yeah, because Hollywood is the propaganda unit of the United States of America. I mean, we are what pushes forth ideology and ideas. I mean, specifically now it's reality TV, personally, or Instagram that pushes this ideology forward. But cinema back in the Hollywood days of yonder.
Yeah,
was.
And it's interesting, too, because you go back in time and... there seem to be less, like now everything is sort of locked down in corporate and people are all sort of trying to stay within the lines of like not rocking the boat too much. So it's hard to get a lot of really overtly political stuff out of that system today. But anyway, I just want to take all the President's Men off the table. It's a great film, but it's not.
Okay,
it's
we're not talking about that
today.
Not
a political bonus body. But I have this sort of theory that there are movies that are, some of the great political movies, one of the things that makes them great is they're fucking insane.
Yeah, for sure.
And I mean, the king of that. And I'm not using the term in a clinical sense. I have no idea. But the king of, like, the insane political movie, I think, is Oliver Stone. Because I look at, like, JFK, which is the theory he puts forth about who killed JFK is so fucking bonkers, is so utterly based in lunacy. There's no, you know, there's so much wrong with it. And who cares? I mean, it's an amazing film. It is an amazing experience. And the thing I love about it is, regardless of the fact that, you know, I don't know if he genuinely believes it or not, he claims to, so more power to him. But the impact that film had on people was, you know, it kicked off a process that led to a ton of the files being released a lot earlier so we could get our hands on them. I mean, I would argue that's actually a good thing in the world.
I think it's a good thing. I think a transparency tends to be a good thing, unless it's a person's privacy.
Yeah. And I do believe that movies have an impact and you have to, like, you have to, at least acknowledge some kind of responsibility, even if you want to go, fuck it, I don't care. Like, you're making movies out of it. It's always like this. It's like Steven Spielberg will go out in the world and make Schindler's List. He'll point to all the good things that movie did. And, you know, and it's like, you're like, yeah, it absolutely did. If we're going to acknowledge that that can happen, we also have to acknowledge that movies can then do harm.
Oh, movies can definitely do harm.
And yeah.
I mean, I'll just cite, I always cite this one, Neon Demon. I don't know if that movie's a good movie or a bad movie. Did me personal harm. I watched, I cried afterwards. I felt so bad about myself after watching that movie. So I'll say that did personal harm towards me. No clue why. I have no idea why.
Oh my God. Okay.
I know. But yeah, movies can do harm.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, no, I think so.
But JFK, you think JFK did more good than...
No, surely, yeah, yeah, because it opened that subject up again, and it's a real thing. It's, you know, I'm not someone, I don't purport to know, but it's so clear that there are aspects of the story that have been kept from us.
Well, yeah.
I mean, the theory that makes the most sense to me is that there were all these disparate groups who wanted him dead, and they all, to some degree or another, assumed that some other part of their faction had done it and proceeded to cover it up, even if they weren't.
Huh.
But, you know, I mean, if you ever get a chance to go there, it's incredible to Dealey Plaza, because it's an amazing thing. It looks exactly the way it did then.
Wow.
You can stand right on the X, and you're standing at the X, and you look over, and you're like, you don't have to have military training. I don't, to go that, well, if I were going to shoot the guy and kill him the way that it was done, I would probably be standing, what is that? Oh, there's a grassy knoll over there. And, oh, there's other than that, there's this window back here that you can't even get a view of the freaking car from the window mm-hmm. that he was supposedly shot from. It all, you know, it would just be nice to admit that there's a possibility that we've been lied to.
Yeah.
And I think he did a lot about opening people's eyes up to that. I think it's a great film. And it is, it's crazy. In the best way, my God, just the editing alone is so...
Well, awesome. I think Oliver Stone is, like, known for his craziness.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah.
And it's fun. Then, that's what makes a movie fun, though. Mm-hmm. I like it crazy. There were a few on that list that I watched that were definitely crazy.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Well, I definitely, at some point, I just want to hear the ones where we'll step on them. But, you know, and then there's stuff like... And this is going back a bit, and it's not, is it crazy? I don't know, like Manchurian Candidate.
I love Manchurian Candidate.
The original one.
Yeah, the original. It's so good.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that movie is amazing.
It's an incredible film, and it sort of posits in an interesting way that the, that you know, at the time in the 60s, early 60s, that the kind of far right in America was kind of in collusion in the film. It's literal, but they're sort of suggesting maybe even just metaphorical with, you know, the worst sort of forces of, like, you know, communist oppression in the world, if you will. And it's such a delightful, paranoid, bonkers vision and so beautifully directed, you know.
Would you think that, like, a movie like Doctor Strangelove is technically a political film?
100%. Yeah, that's on my list.
I was going to say maybe that's my favorite political film then, because that's, like, my favorite.
Well, that's sort of in the realm. It's not just kind of crazy. It's really angry, which I think is another thing that can make political films great if they're well made. I mean, Dr. Strangelove is like, you know, how else are you going to react to the fact that there are people running around engaged in processes in which they think it's reasonable to threaten to kill all of us for their stupid political games?
And also, I love that Kubrick is always talking about systems that fail. And so he's talking about how, like, the political industrial complex and, like, the military is failing. But then also, I just, like, love that he's talking about the pineal gland and, mm-hmm. like, the drinking clean water. Like, because I'm obsessed with that. So when I saw that movie as an adult, I was like,
really? Oh, so purity of essence is your thing?
Yeah, purity of essence. I'm literally him. Like, literally, I was like, oh my God, that's me. Because I'm obsessed with the pineal gland. I don't use fluoride. I'm, like, really specific because I don't want to calcify my pineal gland. So Kubrick was onto something. That's all I can say.
You realize that character's insane, right?
Yeah, maybe I am too. That's the fun of it. We're in Holly Weird right now. So. Yeah.
No, but I think it's the best way. And you know, I guess other people had done it, and satire has always sort of gone to the dark place. I mean, you know, Jonathan Swift suggesting that the Irish eat their children is not, you know, is way before Dr. Strangelove. But that kind of thing, that just sort of taking just sheer comic joy and the horror of it all is such a powerful way of dealing with stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember, you know, I made the mistake back in the day of saying this in some wrong rooms. People get very upset. But, you know, I still think, like, it is sad that we never got the great AIDS comedy that we deserve.
Mm.
You know,
I mean, there's still time.
There is still
time. You can pick up your pen.
But, I mean, talk about, you know, a thing where, like, just this thing is just ripping through a community that is so dispossessed that, like, even the sitting president Ronald Reagan and his team are just, like, laughing about the fact that it's just killing an entire generation of gay men. I'm like, there's only one way I feel like to deal with that in art to get across, and that is like Dr. Strangelove.
Well, because comedy allows you to laugh at things that, like, you otherwise like are that plaguing society.
Can't
and,
look
that,
at
and also you can't look at it and it allows you to discuss them because you're laughing at them.
Yeah. I mean, Doctor Strangelove ends with the end of the world, and it's fucking hilarious.
It ends well. No, it ends with the end of the world, but the beginning of a beautiful society of women that have to copulate with men
exactly.
under the ground.
Exactly.
It's what every man wants in the
That's
end.
That's right. Oh my God, that speech is so amazing. but you know, I love that. I love the craziness because it's like the only way to kind of deal with. I mean, politics is intrinsically madness anyway. It's like we. You know, put these people who are, for the most part, you know, sociopathic, you know, self-obsessed maniacs in charge of things. And then sort of, you know, we graft these kind of like movie star personas onto them, mm-hmm. that are just who they play on TV. And I'm not, I don't care which side you're coming from. I hate to break it to you. That's almost all of them. And then we start expecting, you know, we start talking about them like we know them and we start expecting them to do things and we start judging them in the context of like, you know, some kind of morality that they mostly don't have. And so to deal with politics, you have to deal with kind of insanity. I mean, I don't know, is this movie insane? It's about a guy who goes insane. I love Bulworth, mm-hmm. Warren Beatty's Bulworth. I think it's such a ballsy move. He goes out and does stuff fully knowing that he could completely alienate a lot of the audience, not because of the political nature of it, but just because, what is it, a 60 at that point year old Warren Beatty rapping badly too, by the way, badly. is going to be off-putting to some people, but it's just an amazing movie, and it really is. It's nuts, and it's angry because it's a guy who, I mean, Beatty knows politics, he lives in politics, he knows politicians, and it's a guy just looking at it from the inside and going, this is insane how the system works. And it's like the only way to acknowledge that is to do something insane. Do you know the film or?
No, I don't. No,
he plays a senator.
Oh wait, yeah, I do know this. Actually, I do know this film. That he plays a senator, and he goes like not undercover, but like he's
He hires someone to kill him.
Yeah,
and then because he's had this sort of madness, and then realizes he wants to live after he meets Halle Berry and sort of snaps. He starts being like the rapping because like once he's given up on living, he's sort of like free to
do what he just pleases.
So he goes to all these like, you know, he goes to some gathering in Beverly Hills, and he's like, you know, people ask me why I come here. I come here because it's where all the rich Jews are. What do you think? You know, they're all like, oh, my God. And then, of course, you know, now he's got to try to figure out this guy out there trying to kill him, who he's hired
and how he's to stop
him.
Yeah,
now he's
discovered. A really good. I remember when I read the synopsis for that movie, I was like, this looks really interesting.
It's so fun. It's really a cool film. Stuff like Face in the Crowd, mm-hmm. which is that also falls into a kind of thing like kind of like Network, where you're dealing with people who are angry and seeing the clear future.
Well, Network is interesting. So I watched Network for the first time for this conversation.
Right,
it was because I love Patty Chayefsky. So it's like, of course I have to watch Network. And for me, it falls into the subcategory of movies. I'm developing this genre, thanks to you, called Executive Decisions, because it's about people that are kind of controlled by these big conglomerates. Rollerball falls into that,
sure.
Or Westworld also.
Yeah.
But I liked Network, and
oh, yeah.
He is angry. But one thing I like about Network is how Patty Chayefsky writes women.
Mm-hmm.
She is just as down and dirty as the rest of them, and I love it. Like,
yeah.
He holds no punches whatsoever.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of anger in that film,
yeah.
Both against the system and sexual anger and, like, the family, the nuclear family. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a great film. And I did a podcast about a year ago. It's called Champagne Sharks. A friend of mine runs, and he does a thing every now and then called White Cannon, where he'll take a movie that is just like revered by white people and just completely unknown by black folks. And he'll have like two white guys. I was one of them. And then two black folks talk about it.
Was Network one of them?
We did Network. And it was really interesting because one of the guys we talked to was this older black leftist professor who A, had one of the most brutal and fair critiques of the movie I've ever heard. And B, loves it to death at the same time.
I love that you can like, you can really pick apart a movie but you can still love it.
Oh, how do you not love Network? But he's like, the thing that no one ever talks about is like Patty Chayefsky for all his like, you know, he's raging against this, but he's still like, the whole movie is just like him lamenting the loss of a system that was almost as bad as the one it's being replaced by.
Well, that's why actually Patty Chayefsky has a very tender aspect to him. Like, Hospital is very tender. He wrote it because his wife was not getting the proper care, mm-hmm. in the hospital. And so he wrote the scathing review, basically, of hospitals. And like Altered States, very like loves the answer ending. Mm-hmm. I personally find him very tender.
Yeah,
like he's
lamenting, I don't disagree.
Nostalgic also.
But there is a nostalgia there. And sometimes that nostalgia coming from an older white guy at a time when can have those twinges of like a little bit reactionary there, but it's like, who gives a shit? It's a great movie. You know, I'm not sitting there looking to, and his critique, not his critique, his prediction of what's coming. Like Face in the Crowd, or you, do you know
that? Face in the Crowd. Is Face in the Crowd the one that ends with like the elevator in the tall building?
Is there an elevator?
I can't remember. So tell me what Face in the Crowd is.
Face in the Crowd is Andy Griffith as this kind of like...
he's like a blues guy, and he's like in prison.
Bluegrass kind of dude, yeah, initially.
And yeah, it ends, there's this crazy elevator sequence at the end.
There
like
could
where
be.
I think she goes up like in an elevator. I don't know.
Oh, to his penthouse.
Yes, to his penthouse. Sure. That, yes.
He ends up basically sort of predicting sort of the rise of people like Rush Limbaugh and all that as he becomes this like populist maniac.
Isn't that weird? The one thing I remember is like
penthouse. Somebody else. The problem with that is like what happens is he gets overheard. You know, he's talking on mic about like how much he hates his audience or something like that. And it's like, oh, he's over. And like we all live in a world now where you're like, that wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
That's another sad thing about some of these older films. The end of 3 Days of the Condor, where Robert Redford is facing off his CIA chief, and he's got this information that goes, like, what are you going to do? And he looks, and there's the New York Times. And the implication is he's going to take the story to the New York Times and blow it wide open. And you're like, today, I'd be like, go ahead. Who cares? Nobody
I think
cares.
Today it's also because news moves so fast that people.
Yeah,
are
but
just
it's also
like,
these so many of these institutions are so compromised now, which is something I want to sort of talk about. Kind of this weird thing on, I don't know, call it the left, if you will, but the center, kind of the Democratic center, where their response to weird and terrifying political events of the present is to make movies about the past. So you get, you know, and I think probably the best of these, but it still falls into it, is Clooney's Good Night and Good Luck.
Yeah, that one I was kind of bored by, to be honest.
It's like, there's good performances, but it was made, you know, it was about, theoretically, sort of in response to Bush. And it's like, yeah, here's this thing that happened. It's like, yeah, we used to be able to deal with this stuff better. The Post is the one that kind of made me crazy.
I saw it when it first came out. I did not like it. I did not rewatch it.
Well, it's weird because it's like Spielberg kind of looking at Trump and going, oh my God, this is terrifying. And he's attacking the media. And we need to remind people like that these institutions are, you know, and you go back and it's like, yeah, the New York Times did some stuff 50 years ago that was pretty good. But they're as complicit as anybody in Trump, and they're horribly racist, and they helped sell us the Iraq War. So like going back and showing us, or you know, the Washington Post too, you know, that this place at one point, you know, stood for something doesn't actually reinforce my faith in the institution.
Well, why do you think that they're making political movies about the past?
Because they're afraid to address reality. I think. It's because it's safer.
Well, because I think typically, like, when people are afraid to address reality or the current now, it usually falls into science fiction and horror movies. That's usually where you start setting the themes. Like, but I feel like we're not really doing that either.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. It's like you can, the best way very often to deal with what's happening right now is look, and we've done it in very heavy-handed ways, but, you know, I mean, my all-time favorite go-to Star Trek episode.
Oh, yeah.
The one where they take on racism by having
to
plan it.
Let's talk Star Trek.
People are black on one side and white on the other, and they hate the people who are white on one side and black on the other, and you're like, heavy-handed, but you could do that. You couldn't make that episode about the world today.
Yeah.
In 1966.
They have some really, really great episodes. Like, one of the ones that sprung to mind when you were talking about, like, the racism is there's an episode in TNG where it's a eugenics planet.
Yeah.
And they come and they meet Geordi. And he's blind. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, and she kind of falls in love with him. And then she realizes like, well, I would never have met him like if he was on our planet, because he would never have been born. And it's just like a really excellent way to like expose these things. I love Star Trek. Star Trek is like the pinnacle of writing for me. One of the other movies that I saw that is kind of like a newer movie and talking about a newer thing is, was it Standoff at Sparrow Creek? Is that what it's called?
Oh, did I point you towards that?
Yeah, you did.
Yeah,
and a friend of mine, Walker, like,
I want
really
to get that in
movie.
A minute because I want to talk about like right wing movies that are great. But yeah, just sort of finish up on the past thing. It's just this weird thing, and it just feels so toothless when they kind of, you know, establishment Democrat filmmakers try to like comment on the present by talking about the past. And I just can't ever miss an opportunity to bag on Aaron Sorkin. One of the worst of all time was he Trial of Chicago 7, which I don't know if
I did not watch because also it's a Netflix movie and I don't have Netflix.
Yeah,
did not.
Okay.
And so
he did this insane thing, and it's so frustrating because this is an incredible moment in American history where these, you know, radicals are arrested and tried in this like insane showcase trial. in 1968. And it is just from an entertainment perspective. I mean, they would bring in famous rock stars to like sing in court. And, you know, it could have been a wildly entertaining movie just sticking to that. But Sorkin, who has clearly no curiosity about the past and was not familiar with this story, which is like one of the great American political stories, goes in and kind of takes everything that's interesting out of it. And then he does this thing which he can't help doing, because it seems like all these people yearn for a time that never actually existed. And I think that's why they go back to the past of their minds, where it's like, we all could reach across the aisle and be brothers together and work these things out. And he takes the trial of Chicago 7, in which it was just like, you know, the state trying to crush a bunch of radicals. And he has them all end at the end of the movie kind of, well, the one thing they can agree on is like they end up reading the names of all the American troops who have been killed in Vietnam, and they all stand with their hands on their heart. And what actually happened is Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman came in and started reading the names of all the troops, including Vietnamese, who had been killed during the war in the middle of the trial. And the prosecution and the judge shut them down because they didn't want to have that bullshit in here. And he does crazy shit like, you know, the key moment in the film for me is Abbie Hoffman, who was kind of a hero of mine when I was a kid. Abbie Hoffman wrote a book called Fuck the System. It's literally the title of the book. He has Abbie Hoffman standing on a stage with his hand on a Bible, and they say, do you hate the system? He goes, I believe in the system. There's just a few bad people in it.
Oh, so it's a completely changing the ideology. Basically,
and it's essentially, in this weird way, it becomes a kind of right-wing fantasy.
Do you know why he made these changes?
Yeah, because he's just a hardcore centrist who just wants the world to, you know,
to get along.
He's more mistrusting of the left than he is of the right.
Yeah.
It's a very weird, but that whole impulse to kind of go back into the past and try to show how we dealt with things better and we were better. And it's like, we've always been monkeys and we've always been horrible. You know, yeah. It's like, that's what we do. But to get to, yeah, Sparrow Creek is, and I'm blanking, this is terrible because I brought it up. I can't remember the name of the director, but I wanted to get into like great right-wing movies, because these are movies I do not share anything with politically, but you know, come on.
Did you find it right-wing though?
Well, yeah, it's about a militia.
But just because it's about a militia, though, doesn't necessarily mean it's right-wing. Like, kind of when I watch it, I don't find it to be a right-wing movie.
Really?
Because okay. I don't think it's having the ending message of that film, I don't necessarily, think that it's saying that the militia is correct. I think if the militia was, shown to be, hey, this is, the right thing to do, maybe then it would be considered a right-wing film.
I feel more like it's, there's no real critique of them beyond, they're not handling their shit well. But it seemed to me to be pretty welcoming of them. I know too much. It's, it's from this right-wing film company and the filmmakers.
Oh, there you go.
But again, that's it's interesting that you walked in cold and didn't get that.
The only thing I know about it is my friend Walker, really loves this movie and been trying to get me to watch it. And so when I saw it on your list, I was like, okay, it's time for me to watch it.
It's a cool film. And then you get, stuff, and I think he's involved with the production company. Craig Zoller, I think, was involved with producing that, who did Dragged Across Concrete. And and then you go back to kind of older. My God, Dirty Harry's one of the greatest movies ever made.
I saw Dirty Harry for the first time.
Seriously?
This is off of this. Yeah.
Off of this?
Yeah, I saw.
I wish we could just talk about Dirty Harry.
Dirty Harry, I think, is one of the greatest movies ever made.
Of course it is. Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. And I didn't understand what it was, to be honest. I thought it was a Western. Just because I don't try to read descriptions of things. And
I'm with you. I like Walking in Cold, right?
I know Clint Eastwood is a Western guy. So when I found out it was a cop movie, I was really pumped. And also why is he called Dirty Harry? Is it because he's a peeping? I think he's a peeping Tom. I think that's why. I love it. I loved the movie. And I also it has everything in a movie I like.
Yeah.
I made a list afterwards. I was it has a dirty cop that really wants to do good, but he's doing dirty. It has he'll hit anyone. He'll attack anyone. He's like James Bond in that way. There's a Star Trek actor. The guy that plays Elam Garrick is the villain.
Oh, yeah. What do you think? Oh, my God. Yeah. I love that. Because, to the rest of the world, it's the guy who plays Garrick is fucking scummy.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
and to me,
he's the most terrifying.
To me, I was like,
guy.
Who is that? Oh, my God. It's Garrick. I was
Garrick.
So
yeah.
excited.
Yeah,
but it has
yeah.
everything I love in a movie. And I love that they repeat that initial monologue and they repeat it at the end. And the same outcome happens, any other movie would have.
I know what
you're
thinking. Did he fire 6 shots or only 5? Well, being this is the 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, will blow your head clean off. You got to ask yourself, do I feel lucky? I'm a heterosexual male of a certain age. We all know how to do that.
That was on command. That was awesome.
That and Conan, What Is Best in World, I can do.
So do you think that Dirty Harry's a right-wing film?
Yeah, I mean, it got hammered for that, too. And it kind of is. It's kind of fascistic because he's like this cop who's just solving everything by shooting people and like, you know, got your Miranda right here, you know, all this kind of like,
I mean, but he gets called out. He gets called out, though, about it. Like, hey, we can't go to trial because of all this stuff that you did. It is a critique of him.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. But it's like they're assholes.
They are.
Exactly.
And because, and because there's a girl in a box.
Yeah.
And like, we got to go save her. And like, what are you talking about? I tried to save the girl.
Yeah.
And it didn't work.
I'm all broken up, or I'm all busted up about that man's rights. But he does things that are so, you know, there's stuff like the scene that always boggles my mind because it is shot. And I think what's interesting is, you know, there's also, I think, kind of a struggle in the film of perspectives. I don't know that Don Siegel was quite as, you know, conservative as people make him out, or, you know, and Clint certainly is. But the scene when he goes out and he shoots him in the football field and then he's stepping on his leg.
Oh, it's so, so badass.
They have created a scenario whereby you are watching a police officer physically torture a guy and you are so emotionally invested in what's going on that you're just like, step harder.
That's the best part.
But
the thing is, for me, it's like at that moment, I don't see Clint Eastwood as a police officer. Mm-hmm. I see him as a vigilante. So right, it's like
that's what I was, like neither police officers are out shooting people. They just think
they're
the
good
guys,
not but not all police officers. Like his partner doesn't want anything to do with it. Yeah. Really, like he's like standoffish.
Yeah, and people point it out, and they're right. They're like at the end of the movie, he throws away his badge because he understands that he's sort of done, you know, the wrong thing. But it did get kind of hailed as a right wing film or attacked. I think Pauline Kael, she's going to call it like a fascist work of art, and I wouldn't go that far. But I do. I think it's just it's a little. It feels like. Kind of in the same way that On the Waterfront is an amazing film that is all about justifying a terrible thing that the filmmaker did. This is about putting you in a scenario whereby the worst things that the cops are actually guilty of doing all the time are presented to you in a way in which you're cheering them.
It's so
that's
funny.
Kind of inherently.
It's so funny, though. Like, is that the general consensus that he throws away his badge because he thinks he's done the wrong thing?
Or is I'm just saying, but it's like when people come at it a little hard, I'm like, you do understand that he like throws away because he realizes he can't be a cop anymore.
Because yeah, like the way I saw it when he throws away his badge, it's because the police force doesn't actually stand for justice. And so for me, I don't find that to be right wing. I find that to be like the police force should stand for justice.
Oh, no,
and justice
I don't.
Is
I'm saying at the
served.
End, it's like whatever it is, his reason for yeah. throwing it away at least indicates that he understands it doesn't fit in that system.
Like he does not fit in the system.
But
yeah.
it is like a classic.
Oh, it's
I mean,
so
it really is. The term didn't exist for 20 years after or 30 years after, but it's like propaganda. It's like you're purely inside him.
Oh, I love
you're
it.
Pure, I love it to death.
I think propaganda might be one of my new favorite genres.
It's a great genre. And I have no problem. I know people are like, I won't see that. I'm like, dude, it's like, I don't believe in vampires either. I like a vampire movie. I can easily go.
You're
going to
go watch Twilight? You're
going
to go watch Twilight?
Yeah, cops stink. But yeah, exactly. But you know, I saw it. I think the last time I saw it in a theater, Edgar Wright had programmed it at the New Beverly, and most of the audience hadn't seen it. And it's just that scene when the school bus comes around the corner and Harry's standing
so
on the
good.
Bus, the theater exploded. People were just like jumping up and down, cheering and like how do you not?
I mean, it's akin because it's akin in the same vein to like Death Wish, where he's not a cop, but he goes on this vigilante justice for like his wife and daughter. And so like you're rooting for him. And so it's almost like, because I've seen Death Wish before, clearly I've seen Dirty Harry. So for me, it's like ingrained that like this guy that he's chasing is a racist, sexist serial killer who is also attacking children. Like, this guy needs to be get back.
Yeah, he's got it coming.
You gotta,
he's got it coming.
Just desserts.
Sure.
Like, is someone out there that will. It's the same thing with superheroes, though.
Yep.
Every superhero is technically like Batman and Spider-Man. They're all doing like what Dirty Harry's doing. They just don't have a badge.
Kinda, I mean, I'm kind of with Alan Moore, and I'm a huge comic fan. Alan Moore is just like superheroes are intrinsically fascist. I'm like, of course they are, but they're fun.
Yeah.
And of course, it's worth. You should now see Magnum Force then, which I like almost as much.
I
want
to see the
Harry.
Whole series. There's like five of them.
They go downhill after the first two, but Magnum Force is great because it's almost an answer to some of the critics because it's about a bunch of cops. And I won't spoil it for you, but there's a sort of team of cops, and it's like, you know, young Robert Urich, young David Soul, all these guys are going to be big stars who worship Dirty Harry but don't quite get him.
Yeah,
he's inexplicably back of the force. There's no, but you know, whatever. And then he's got to take them on, and it's great. I love it. It's got one of my favorite Harry lines of all time, which is a man's got to know his limitations. But yeah, it's worth seeing back to back. You'll enjoy it. But you know, then how about something like Red Dawn, which is just like openly.
Well, that's John Milius,
insane.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And, well, then there's no. I feel like there's no arguing. Like, it's John Milius. Yeah. John Milius is like, I love him. I know him. I love him. I think he's great. I think he's one of the best writers out there. He is also like a total NRA. Like,
and there's something about it, the way he does it, that's just kind of weirdly charming. I had a job. I used to do crew, and I was working on this movie, Warlock, in the 80s with Julian Sands. And I had an office at a lot that Milius had worked on something previously. So I was in Milius's old office, and his Soldier of Fortune magazines would come to my office. And I wish I still had them. Having a copy of Soldier of Fortune with John Milius's name on it would
be. And but also, like, John, what I love about him is, like, he really knows his stuff. And so that's why I feel like his movies work, because, one, he really knows his stuff. Like, he's really an expert on all these firearms, and, like, he knows everything about war. Like, he is just a genius.
But let's be fair. Red Dawn has the Russians and whoever they're using as their proxy, I can't remember, invading the United States from the middle, which is still one of the...
That's awesome,
though. The movie's so dumb, and it's so fun. And it's so crazy, right-wing paranoid. You're like, who gives a shit? It's just like, it's entertaining.
Yeah.
You know, it's not boring. Are we there? I feel like we're...
Oh, I thought you were.
And so that's the thing I love. It's like, just go for it. Don't be tepid. I don't mind. You know, it's like, I'm not sitting there, like, judging the politics of a movie. I don't judge the politics of a movie unless you're giving me nothing else to judge, I guess is it.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there watching Chicago 7, and I just want to, like, pound Aaron Sorkin in the head because you're giving me nothing entertaining.
But also, Chicago 7 is about a real trial that did occur, and it's not showing the real things that happened in the trial. So maybe is that your issue partially with the film?
No, because, again, JFK. It's like complete horseshit. I have no problem.
Well, like
with
Winter
that.
Kills is a really good example. Winter Kills, JFK. I've seen Winter Kills like 3 or 4 times this year so far. I love that movie, and it's really excellent because it's like a proxy of JFK and like what could have happened for this whole thing. And obviously, it's not true, but it's really fun. But like, there is a political agenda there, I guess, because it is tied to JFK.
Yeah. And he's trying to say something about kind of like corporate America and greed and power. And I have a friend who's directing a movie with Jeff Bridges right now who had never seen it. And I just made him watch it. And he's like, holy shit, this movie's insane. I love it.
Yeah, I love that
I
movie.
Mean, it's great. It's bonkers. But yeah, if you're going to, you know, if you're going to mangle truth, be fun about it, I guess, is my thing. Like, for, oh, God, it's so sad. I mean, this is me. I seek these things out. I don't know if you remember. There's a movie called My Son Hunter that just came out. That Robert Davi, the actor, directed. And I had very low expectations, but there's that party that's hoping. Because he's like this complete right-wing. Oh, can I finish?
Yeah, you can finish your sentence,
He's this complete right-wing Looney Tune.
And he's I love Robert Davi.
Biden. Yeah, he's great. But he's made this movie about Hunter Biden and all the stuff there. And I'm like, it could have been so bonkers and so fun. And it's so boring. Like, they didn't have a lot of money. I get that. I don't mind that. It just, instead of, like, doing anything with it, it just becomes a recitation of all their weird, you know, some of which are very true, some of which are clearly insane allegations against him. And they just sort of basically list them all in the form of a movie. And you're like, this could have been so much fun. This could have been insane. I would have been so happy to watch a movie about, like, Hunter Biden running around, like, snorting coke.
His laptop his and, like, and, you know, I'm not going to, I'm not going to, I'm not going to respouse what I've read.
Yeah.
Our time is up.
It is.
Josh, is there any final thought that you'd like to leave the audience with?
Too many. Finally, we barely touched on this, but just be careful of like tying your sense of your virtue or other people's virtue and the kind of art they enjoy, because you know it's not what you think. It's like good stuff is good stuff, and you might not be able to separate one thing from the other, but some people can, and it's like. You know,
art from artists or politics from
exactly. Yeah, it's like there's so many. It's like, yeah, oh my God, if you're gonna stop enjoying films because they were made by assholes and monsters, people, I have bad news for you. We haven't even begun to scratch the surface of how awful most filmmakers or writers or painters
or anyone singers, or doctors or lawyers, etc. etc.
It's like, stop already. You're not going to hell because you liked a Roman Polanski film. Sorry, you're not. Unless it's his last one, which I've seen clips from. And have you seen this?
I have not seen it yet.
Yeah, just Roman. If you see the words Roman Polanski in comedy, just run.
Oh, but I like Roman Polanski comedies, like The Tenant. That's a comedy.
I'm talking comedy.
I'll have to see you and report back. But thank you, Josh, for coming on to the show. If you'd like to keep up with him, you can check him out on Twitter at Joshua R. Olson or over on his podcast, The Movies That Made Me.
Awesome.
At Trailers from Hell.
At Trailers from Hell.
I'm Gala Avery, and this has been The Gala Show. The Gala Show is brought to you by Insertomatic. This episode was executive produced by Roger Avery and produced by Gala Avery. Music composed by Andy Milburn. As always, I'm your host, Gala Avery. Copyright 2023, all rights reserved. Despite me sharing the same last name with this charity, I don't have any affiliation with it, besides the fact the issue is very near and dear to my heart. Did you know that in the United States, 2.7 million children currently have a parent in prison, and it's estimated that 10 million children have experienced parental incarceration at some point in their lives? I was one of these kids, and as an adult, I am really grateful to be able to give back to Project Avery. Their mission is to build leadership from within by supporting community through programs such as mentoring and outdoor education, and also to remove the stigma surrounding having a parent that's incarcerated. You don't have to feel alone. If you know a kid who could use these resources or would like to donate money or time to the charity, please go to Project Avery, that's AVARY.org, to check out what this amazing charity is all about. Again, that's ProjectAvery.org. Thank you guys from the bottom of my heart.